Okay, so once a week, typically on Thursday, but this week it's on Friday, after Shacharis, I discuss a few Rashis from the Parsha. And not the reason I learn Rashi, you can learn Rashi for need a reason. But sometimes, especially here in Yeshiva, the classics get a little bit neglected because Baruch Hashem, we're learning Tanakh in ways that haven't been explored in the past. And Menachem Litek's Parsha share, we're encouraging you to read them independent of the Mefarshim just to see from a literal level. But sometimes people forget of the great, great Mefarshim throughout generations who have commented on the Parsha. And with Rashi in particular, because there is a, it's hard to call it a mitzvah, but there's a very strong minhag in Am Yisrael, which I'm sure you've heard of, but I'm not sure if everyone is still yet on board, called Shnayim Mikra Vechatargam. It's based on the Gemara and Brachos. You should read the psukim, two psukim, twice, each pasuk twice, and then either the Targum or Rashi. There are plenty of apps that are available. So this is a really good time if you're not yet performing or covering Shnayim Mikra Vechatargam. This is a really good chance to start a yeshiva. Like I said, apps make it very easy. If you really don't have a lot of time, you can rely on listening to the Chazan as one of your rounds of Mikra. So you just have to read the Pasuk once and either Rashi or Unkelus once and then say along with the Chazan or listen to the Chazan or the Pasuk like that. So everyone should try to think of now, if you're not already involved in Shnayim Mikra Vechatargam, it's something that should last with you your entire life. Okay, so let's learn a few Rashis from Parshas Shoftim. So one of the interesting Rashis, we'll go back to the beginning, I have it on my phone here. One of the interesting Rashis is Hashem says, "V'osakim l'cha matseva, asher sanei Hashem elokecha." You shouldn't in any way construct or worship at a shrine built around the matseva. So what's the difference between a matseva and a mizbeach? So Rashi says a matseva is even achas, just one stone or one standing stone, one vertical stone. And this is a very harsh word. Asher sanei Hashem elokecha. Hashem hates a matseva. Just say don't worship at a stone. So Rashi says that this stress and this emphasis is reminding you that even though the avos really enjoyed matzevos, all of our avos erected matzevos, matzevos oven, throughout Sefer Bereishis. So you think, well, if the avos already enshrined it and institutionalized it, then it should be something which is sacred, which is legit. So why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu dislike it? So Rashi says, because even though the avos launched matzevos and they conceived of a matzeva, at some point, the pagan world adopted matzevos. And once the pagan world adopts matzevos, then it becomes associated with paganism. And at that point, asher sanei Hashem elokecha. Now this is an interesting paradigm where there are, in this case, objects or articles that have sanctity because Jewish people, in this case our avos, institutionalize it and use it as part of worship. But then once it becomes associated with other religions, then it shifts and it becomes something which is, in this case, odious, not something which is appropriate. You wouldn't think that. You'd think that the Kedusha within a location or the Kedusha within an object, an article, should be inherent, should be innate, and it shouldn't be a product of social convention or religious adaptation. You think once the avos establish a matseva, then the pagan world doesn't have the ability to reroute it or to redefine it. And yet you see that that's the nature, and it happens with matsevos. And it happened with locations. There are places in Yerushalayim today, which used to have Kedusha, which used to be places that Am Yisrael lived and were part of Kedushas Yerushalayim for Maaser Sheni, for Korbanos, and they were adopted and taken by other religions, and now you're not allowed to walk in there. What do you mean? These were places where our Avos used to eat Korbanos. But once Avodah Zarah adopts these places, they become off-limits to us. Now, what's interesting about it, is this a good thing or a bad thing? So you would think it's a terrible thing, right? How could a matzeva that used to be part of the Avodas Hashem of our avos be now incorporated within the world of Avodah Zarah? It may be unfortunate, but in some ways it's not fortunate, but it's a byproduct of the fact that we're introducing monotheism to this world, and our goal is to try to inspire people towards more religious values, hopefully greater monotheism, and by the end of history, a monotheism that will be pure and will be centered only on Hashem, without prophets, without false children of Hashem. We're moving the world forward to that. Now, part of that is that the world is going to be receiving our messages, and whenever the world will be receiving our messages, they'll also be taking part of our world in trying to grow it, and that's the backwash of our monotheistic mission. So when you think about places in Yerushalayim, when you think about a Maseva, and I talked about it earlier this week when you think about Tanakh. Are we happy that Christians and Muslims learn Tanakh? Are we happy that Christians and Muslims converted Tanakh, to a degree distorted Tanakh, for their own typological reasons? Well, read a very fascinating Sefer, the Ramban. In the 13th century, the Ramban, who we're spending so much time this week studying and learning, the Ramban in the 13th century was involved in a very famous, 12th century, very famous disputation in Barcelona. Pablo Cristiani, actually one of the Ramban's students, ratted out the Jews, accusing the Talmud of crimes against humanity, negative things about other religions, and Judaism is put on trial, one of the famous medieval disputations. The Ramban valiantly defended Judaism, but of course the verdict was in before the trial began, and the Jews of Barcelona were in terrible depression after going through this traumatic experience. They were being ridiculed in the streets, they were being accused of treason, they were being imprisoned. So the Ramban wrote a sefer called Taras Hashem Tamima, a small little booklet. And one of his basic points, which people don't realize often enough, is that from a historical standpoint, Christianity and Islam are tragedies, because they persecuted the Jews, because they punished us, because they're part of our exile. But from a theological standpoint, we're actually happy that Christianity and Islam replaced the ancient voodoo, paganism, the idolatry of worshiping sea monsters and grotesque figures in Shemayim and forests and eating mushrooms and that whole underworld of darkness, that these are enlightened religions which articulate monotheism. And not only are they articulating monotheism, but they're doing our job for us. We don't have the time to go to Indonesia and convert the Aborigines into monotheists. We don't have the time to go to South America and convert the Aztecs or the Mayans into monotheists. So Christianity lifted ideas from Judaism. Islam lifted ideas from Judaism. They created partial blends of monotheism, which are far superior to the ancient voodoos and paganism of antiquity. And they spread it across the world. And look at the world we live in today. The world we live in today is by and large. I know when I go to America to interview, I go typically Christmas time. I know the word Christmas when you live in America is a very abrasive term because it surrounds you and it envelops you. So you don't really wish people Merry Christmas unless you absolutely have to, like at work. I feel very comfortable because, again, I'm not part of that cultural envelope. When I see people on planes and I say Merry Christmas because, to a degree, I'm happy this Christmas because it replaced all these ancient pagan rites of burning your children to Moloch and sorcery and necromancy. So there's going to be a backwash when we spread our values to the world. It's going to be distorted. Parts of our world will be adopted by these religions, but that's the price. That's the operating price. The operating price for having, of performing our mission. We're not meant to be a secluded race sitting in an ivory tower. We're meant to spread the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When we spread the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we're happy. Are we happy that Yerushalayim was targeted by every religion? Are we happy that every single religion is contesting our place in Yerushalayim? Of course we are. I wish it would be easier to live in Yerushalayim. I wish it would be easier to live in Gush. But the reason this is so contested is because this is the center of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence, and everyone knows it subconsciously. Everyone knows it subliminally. So there's going to be a contest, there's going to be a distortion, there's going to be a perversion, there's going to be this Matzevas oven that Rashi's describing is a prototype. It's not just about Matzeva, it's describing a phenomena that has repeated itself throughout history, not just with the Matzeva, but with location, with ideas, with Tanakh, and it's reflective of our mission to spread the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, there's another interesting Rashi. Where is this Rashi? Okay, here, it's about the Melech. Okay, the reason he has to have a separate Sefer Torah. Okay, one of the terms of Mishneh Torah, Sefer Devarim is called Mishneh Torah. Why is Sefer Devarim called Mishneh Torah? Because it's a repeat run of Mishneh Torah. There are other reasons that Chazal suggests. But the phrase Mishneh Torah, which of course was so iconic for the Rambam, and the Rambam chose that title for his Sefer. He called his Yad Chazaka Mishneh Torah. But the actual term Mishneh Torah appears in Parsha Shoftim. And it refers to the second Sefer Torah that a Melech has to write. Every Jew has a mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah. It's becoming more and more in vogue today to write a Sefer Torah. For thousands of years, it was prohibitively expensive and almost logistically impossible to write a Sefer Torah. So the Rush Paskins, and in our day, a very good rush for many of you to hear today. In our day, the way we're mekayim the mitzvah of ksiva sefer Torah is by buying svarim. So some of you are going to go buy svarim today. Tell your parents, well, I just couldn't hold out. It was a mitzvah, and I had to spend up to lachomesh, and you gave me a $4,000 quota this year, but I had to spend $800 of that because Al Yavazve is Yosef Mechomesh, have to be up to Lechomesh for mitzvahs, so you can buy $800 of Svarim today there. Don't tell your parents I said that. So every Jew has to either buy Svarim or write a Sefer Torah, but a Melech has a mitzvah to write a Mishneh Torah, a second Sefer Torah. And the difference between the first Sefer Torah and the second Sefer Torah, the primary difference is that the regular Sefer Torah that you and I are chayiv to write, we can leave in our home. I actually have a Sefer Torah in my home. We can leave in our bookcase. We can leave in our own HaKodesh. But the Mishneh Torah the Melech has to write has to be with him on his presence. So if you're a Melech, you have to carry this, not personally, but you have to carry V'haisimo Kol Yimei Chayav. The Sefer Torah, the second Sefer Torah of a Melech, has to carry with him. Why? So in part because he actually has to teach Torah wherever he goes. Now, if you're a teacher of Torah in the days of Tanakh, there's only one Sefer you have, and that's the Sefer Torah. There's no Gemara. So when you'd go and teach Torah, you'd bring your Sefer Torah, put it down on a table, open the Sefer Torah, and start teaching. Rabbi Soloveitchik used to say, whenever you see a Gemara or a Medrash that says, Pasach Rav Kahana, Pasach Rav Oshia, Pasach Rav Yehuda, we think he began his comments. Ladies and gentlemen, this is what I'm going to talk about. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, no, he opened the Sefer Torah. Because there was no svar. Like, when I'm going to open a ksuvas today, when I'm going to open my Maseches Ksuvas, I'm going to start learning. They didn't have a Maseches Ksuvas. They had a Sefer Torah. They put Sefer Torah down on the table. He started reading. One of the roles of a Melech is to teach Torah. His role is to conquer Eretz Yisrael, to build the base of Mikdash, to lay down Malek. How do we know one of the roles of a Melech is to teach Torah? Who was the first Melech? Okay, trick question. Of course, Shaul. But according to Chazal, who was the first Melech? Moshe Rabbeinu. How do we know that Moshe had a status of a Melech? Which Pasuk Chazal interpret as a reference to Moshe? Simple reading of the pasuk is HaKadosh Baruch Hu Bishur Melech. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Bishur, and Yishurun is a nickname for the Jewish people, Yisrael, Yishurun. But Chazal interpreted, Vahi Bishur Melech Moshe. How could Moshe be a Melech? He didn't come to Eretz Yisrael. He didn't conquer Amalek. He didn't build the base of Mikdash. He did nothing that a Melech typically accomplishes. The answer is he taught Torah. So Melech's role is to teach Torah. There are a lot of halachas, actually, that Rabbi Soloveitchik talked about that stem from Moshe's status as a Melech. Real halachas, not just we describe him in theory as a melech. So the melech has to teach Torah, so he has to say for Torah. But at least from the Parsha and Shoftim, it sounds like the primary reason he has to say for Torah with him on his body is that he shouldn't get haughty, he shouldn't get arrogant, he shouldn't become abusive, he shouldn't have absolute power. So the Sefer Torah is a spiritual corrective. He has a Sefer Torah with him, doesn't have too many wives, doesn't have too much riches, too many horses. So hopefully, how do we establish a monarchy, right? We live, thank God, in a world of democracy. I say thank God because it's the best form of government that human beings have been able to craft. But as you're starting to see, and you'll continue to see in your lifetime, it's terribly flawed. It's structurally flawed democracy. We should support democracy. We should be part of democracy. We should participate in democracy because it has alleviated thousands of years of human suffering. But you see the inherent problems of democracy. Thank God it's the best we have. In the 20th century, there are two great, not great, but two pernicious movements that challenged democracy. And each of these movements suggested that democracy was too weak to defeat evil. So Hitler believed that he would conquer Europe by the time the Congress got together and voted to go to war. He would already be standing on the banks of the English Channel. So that was his gamble. And thank God, democracy was adroit enough to gather its forces and to defeat Hitler. And the same challenge was launched by communism, where Stalin believed that he could launch his communist juggernaut and steamroll the West because what democracies by their nature are too weak to defend against absolute power that tries to impose evil and suffering on people. And thank God democracy proved its mettle, proved its strength in the 20th century by defeating each of these movements. I don't know how long it will last. I don't know how long we're suffering through a very, very big crisis of democracy. In America in particular, you guys are probably feeling it much worse than I am. But it's identity politics and intersectionality and the hatred and the polarization that democracy leads to. We are not yearning for a world of democracy. We're yearning for a melech. We're yearning for a world of monarchy. And that word monarchy sounds so offensive to us because for thousands of years it was abused by people with absolute power, acted immorally and corruptly and abused their subjects and bled them dry and murdered them and concentrated wealth and riches. How do you create a what's the word I'm looking for? I'm too tired. What's the word that's actually, or not a munificent monarchy, but a benevolent monarchy? How do you create a monarchy which is benevolent, in which the king has power and uses the power to create order and stability in ways that democracy cannot, and policies in ways that democracy cannot, but still doesn't abuse the power? That's what Parsha Shoftim is aiming for. And part of the ways that it accomplishes this, have a Sefer Torah, but part of the ways what Rashi says, this is what I was thinking about in Rashi, Rashi says, Levilti rem levavah me'achad, we shouldn't be too haughty. Levilti sor min ha-mitzvah. And he shouldn't avoid any mitzvahs, yamin u'smal. What does it mean, sor min ha-mitzvah? Of course, he has to keep all the mitzvahs. Levilti sor min ha-mitzvahs. What is levilti sor min ha-mitzvah? So Rashi says, afilo mitzvah kala shel navi. Not only is a melech subservient to the mitzvahs, as you and I are, he's also beholden to the word of a navi. And if you read Tanakh carefully, there's a very delicate balance between the Navi and the Melech. And the Navi was always the moral conscience of the Melech. And the Melech was always meant to listen to the Nevi'im. And when Nasan the Navi comes and critiques David on his sin, David says, Chatasi, he sins. Shmuel Beis Perek Yadalit. And when Yeshaya comes and critiques Chizkiah about his sin, Chizkiah starts to daven. And in a functional Jewish monarchy, the Navi, in some ways, has more spiritual, not authority, and more spiritual conscience than the Melech, and the Melech is meant to listen. And part of the breakdown of the first Beis HaMikdash is when the people at large, and the Melechim in particular, no longer listen to the Nevi'im. And you start to see this in the days of Yirmiyah, who was arrested, who was almost executed, who was miraculously saved. So the ideal is there should be some, as we would call it in our world, checks and balances, but spiritual checks and balances. Now, for us, very few of us here are going to be Melechim, of course, because most of us can't raise ourselves to Machus based on it, and even if we could, I don't know whether we'll be nominated as the Melech. So the message for us is always have those checks and balances in your life. Always have people that you listen to. One of the breakdowns in modern Orthodox society, right? Every society has its own breakdowns. One of the breakdowns in modern Orthodox society is self-arbitration. If you look at the Haredi world, there's a very clear hierarchical structure. And at the top of the pyramid is something called Das Torah. And when the Gadol, whoever that Gadol is, speaks, you listen to him, not just about halachic and moral issues, but even about whom to marry and economic decisions. We could talk about the pros and cons, the dangers, the strengths. I'm just highlighting and contrasting. In our world, we veer more towards Bechira Chavshis, and certainly Bechira Chavshis in the world of, not that they're not executing Bechira Chavshis, they're using Bechira Chavshis to depend upon a higher truth. But we believe that Bechira Chavshis should be employed in a day-to-day basis by every individual. But because of that, we're starting to lose rabbinic authority, moral authority. Ask yourself, I don't know your parents that well, I'm not looking at anyone in particular, but think about your parents and the adults in your life that you know, your uncle, your family, whatever. How many people that you know in life don't have any moral authority they would listen to very carefully? And when that person speaks, they may not obey with blind obedience, but at least they listened to carefully. When Rav Lichtenstein spoke to me, when I asked him advice, even if I disagreed with his suggestion, and he demanded, not that I accept his word as blind obedience, but I think about it and make my own decision, and sometimes I disagreed, I listened really carefully. I thought about it for a few days, and before I did, I said, this is a person with deep moral authority. I better listen to what he has to say, not just about Pesach HaLach. I have Pesach HaLach, you listen. End of conversation. But moral questions, religious questions, life, relationships. How many people are self-arbitrators? How many people in our world don't have any voices? They know better. And it's a breakdown in our community. And part of the way I want you to lead your life is to find people. Doesn't have to be rabbis. It could be people with moral integrity, respect. Hopefully it'll be your spouse. Hopefully the person you choose to marry will be someone whose moral position, moral conscience, wisdom of life you respect so deeply that you listen to that person very carefully. It's important to be a listener. Even if you're a king, certainly if you're a king, obviously none of us are thinking in those contexts, but make sure you listen to other people's moral input, or else you just cast adrift and you do what you think is right. And what. And that's where our democracy is spiraling towards, the democracy of 350 self-arbitrators, 350 self-mediators. Everyone knows what's right. And of course, if everyone knows what's right, it's going to be a lot of violence when you feel that a person on the other side of the aisle is opposing your policy, or in the other lane next to you is cutting you off on the road because you're the only one that has a monopoly on truth and everyone else is an idiot and they're taking advantage of your life, so why not just... So be very, very careful. Dr. Shefton talks about the society we build, and so much of our society is, thank God, we're fortunate to live in a world of democracy and freedom and protection of rights, but so much of us starting to see the underbelly and the seamy side of it, and how can we build a world that is superior to the world that we're... Thank God, I'd rather live in this world than live in the world of feudalism and monarchies and ancient monarchies. But it's still a world that provides a lot of existential challenges to us. Okay? So, we're going to stop here. I'm going to ask three boys to come with me to the kitchen, and we'll get hopefully, the breakfast that was prepared for us. I'm hoping. Davin, everyone else stay here and say Tehillim.